Hi everyone, I'm Peter. I'm a compulsive overeater and I have been asked to speak tonight. And so for that, I'm grateful to Pam to invite me. It's my experience that when I'm asked to do service, it's a yes. It just isn't always the case that it's a yes, but the rule of thumb for me is it's a yes. I heard at the beginning of the meeting there were some newcomers or people returning, and so my first priority is to welcome you. It's the first time, my first time in this meeting, but I've been in OA for coming on for 14 years. So anyone who is new to this program or new or coming back or struggling with food and with life and the combination of the two, you're in good company. Our first priority as fellows in this program, you are our first priority. You are my first priority. So I hope there's something I say that is helpful in any way. But if there isn't, I promise you there are many other people who have so much wisdom and vulnerability in different meetings and in different times. So I was told to keep coming back, and that's certainly what I did. And I wouldn't really be alive if I hadn't kept on coming back, let alone having a life that I really love. So I think that the interesting thing is, I had to quickly fill in the form to give permission to be recorded, and I hadn't done that right, and then someone was sending me the form and I couldn't find it. And that's a perfect description of my experience of life. There has always been a feeling like I'm kind of doing it wrong. I'm doing things wrong. I'm kind of out of sorts. I don't quite get it. There's a fundamental insecurity and a sense of not belonging and a sense of not being safe. And that's not the full story. There's a hell of a lot else in the painting of my life, but that is all true, what I just said. That is all a true experience that I didn't really feel safe. And for me, as I grew older, it was food that became a sense of safety. Or if it wasn't safety, it was a sense of numbing the feeling of insecurity and of not belonging and of just the kind of unbearable pain, really. Also, I've realized through actually a fellow that I'm a real empath. I have the gift and the curse of really feeling what everybody else is feeling, and I pick up on everything like an emotional sponge. I was that from a baby. I'm that now. I feel everyone's things deeply. Before program, I thought it was my job to fix those people. Of course, I couldn't. I still can't. But what I can do is if I live my life in a healthy way, I have the capacity to be of service. It's very different to fixing people. Of course, I couldn't even understand what that meant until I had a sense of my own identity and a sense of my own humanity and vulnerability. So, just to kind of qualify, I was born into a very insecure world, a very unhappy marriage between my parents. I was the kid that was going to save the marriage. They weren't really great friends. I think there was other people involved. There was just it was messy. It was a messy, messy world I was born into. But there was a lot of love. So it was like messy love, like a big. You can almost imagine the dish in a buffet of messy love. It sounds like a dessert, doesn't it? Messy love. Yeah, it tastes good, but it's not necessarily very good for you. That's kind of what I was born into, messy love. A lot of unresolved issues, a lot of intergenerational trauma from people having been in the Holocaust, the intergenerational trauma from that, to then being kind of freedom fighters in apartheid South Africa, where we were suddenly on the different side from being persecuted Jews. We were suddenly, of light skin in South Africa. So that was very confusing indeed. And fortunately, my parents managed to leave there, and we moved to England. And it was in England where I first discovered how to feed my face. That's how my grandpa used to describe it. I need to feed my face, he used to say. I also love that expression. It's like as if our face is a completely different entity altogether. It's a being that needs feeding. It's not myself, it's my face. And I was just in London, and my father, who is still alive, he showed me these photographs, and in these photographs was the story of my eating disorder. It was all these hidden photographs. I had no idea they were there. And there was me, age 17, as a rake, as skinny as a rake. And then there was me at 18 or 19, the width of four people. The same person, only 2 years apart. I couldn't believe the width of me. Even I couldn't believe it, and it was me. And then I couldn't believe, like, even when I was skinny, I felt fat. And when I was fat, I just felt horrible. And I really didn't have any compassion for myself. I didn't know I had an eating disorder. I wasn't the lucky person who was told he had an eating disorder when he was young. I just somehow muddled through life, ballooning up and down, along with a lot of other people in my family. And on my father's side is the restrictive side, the kind of anorexic side. And my mother's side was more of the compulsive overeater. So I kind of had it from both sides. And I went more with the and it was all connected to love or lack of love. It's all connected to trying to fix other people, and trying to hide. It's really ironic. I don't know if anyone else can identify with, but isn't it ironic that I was wanting to hide my feelings, but by doing that, I became bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until I was several people wide. And in that width, I really wanted to hide, but I never could. And I realize now as a father that is really a child screaming out for help. My late mother would have said, this is a cry for help, but it's such a twisted cry. It's so unclear, the messaging of that pain. And of course it is, as I've learned, it is a disease. At first, I wasn't comfortable with that term, a disease. It didn't feel, I don't know, it didn't feel like it described adequately the delicate, cunning, baffling, and wildly deceitful psychological side of my eating disorder. So deceitful was it, I didn't realize I even had an eating disorder until I was 40. I mean, it was like it was a spy in my body. My eating disorder was like a Russian spy, or like a devious spy, like living inside of me, undetected for all these years until everything was on the line. And I was very clear that if I did not go into recovery or seek help in for an eating disorder, that I was going to lose, an incredible amount of things in my life that I was slowly evolving in my personal life, with my family, and with my work as well. The kind of fog of food, people speak about the fog of war in England, the fog of war. It was this, like, and I think for me it was the fog of food. I could go whole weekends, whole nights, whole days just in this fog. And with food came other bad decisions, or not helpful decisions, involving, yeah, it was just part of a very Very hedonistic and self-destructive behavior, but it wasn't consistent. Like I would suddenly get really healthy. It was the compulsion. Suddenly get really healthy and really skinny. And then it would, and I'd get into a relationship and slowly I'd get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until I became unlovable. Until I would be like, really? Are you sure you like me still? You still like me? Even now? Another 20 pounds, 40 pounds more, another 100. You sure you love me? Because I'm pretty sure. And of course, by the end of that, these relationships would always break down. So my relationship with God, I remember being superstitious as a child. I remember saying to myself, if I do this, then that will happen. And I remember having conversations with this concept of God, but it was slightly paranoid. And then I learned to kind of argue about things. I learned about the rational world, and then I held on to a spiritual belief, but the idea of God was very troublesome for me. It's very difficult because it was tied up with things that to me felt like it was keeping people apart in the world and fighting over things. And that was maybe my rational self trying to persuade myself that I didn't need help. Maybe that was my disease, the cunning, baffling, and powerful disease that it is. And often when I share, I talk about God too late in my share, and that's why I asked Renee for 5 minutes before, because I really don't want to leave that word till the end, because actually it's kind of a that word is everything actually for me now. So I've heard a lot of people share when they came into program, they felt like they were being fraudulent by using the word God or not understanding the word God. And I was a little bit like that. But I was like that about saying I had an eating disorder. I mean, I was so full of shame. I think this idea of never belonging, I didn't even think I never belonged anywhere. So I can't possibly belong to a group of people who identify as having eating disorders. But guess what? I absolutely belong here. 100% belong here, and I always will. And I've learned in this program, number one, that it is not about our differences, it is about our similarities. We have much more in common, all of us on this Zoom and beyond anyone. We have much more in common than our differences. So I can choose to see our differences, but really they're not interesting, and they're certainly not helpful in terms of being of service. The gratitude I have for being in this program solidly for 14 years, there are no words, and my life is I can't pretend that the last 14 years have been raindrops and roses and whiskers on kittens. I mean, there's been a lot of suffering. There's been, yeah, it's been really some heavy stuff has happened in my life, of all kinds, a lot of grief and a lot of, but I have embraced all that's come my way from within the safety and the belonging of OA. So OA is my home. I'm talking to a group of people. Some are on camera, some aren't. Really, I have no idea who you are. And guess what? I feel completely safe and comfortable having this most intimate of shares to tell you that I was really in trouble. And no matter how it was my kind of, I was born with a bit of a natural ability to kind of charm. So that was like my big deceit of how to get away with having this eating disorder. I'd still managed to, get a girlfriend, no matter how heavy I was. I still managed to I could sing, so I was able to sing to people, and somehow I kind of presented myself as a different way to how I really was, but inside was this very, very struggling person. And the love that I experienced from my mum, who also shared this disease, and one of my great
I've been a
regret,
reminder.
thank you, was that my mum died before I was able to really bring this program to her. I was able to make an amends to her before she died, thank God. It was such a relief to say to her, Mum, I'm so, but for all that I have been, it was always so much blame towards her. And then the amends was the opposite of blame. It was an apology. It was an acknowledgement of the wreckage of my eating disorder and the way that would just be aimed at the people I love the most, and the destruction that would happen after a binge, and all the decisions that would happen after that. Wreckage. We talk about the wreckage of our past. I didn't think that was the case at the time. I thought I was really nice. I was a really nice guy. But guess what? No. And I'm not only a nice guy now, I'm a very intense person. I laugh a lot. I feel a lot. But I am comfortable with all those feelings because I have surrendered to my higher power. And I do that every day because as soon as I think I'm in control, that is my disease, that is my addiction, that is my alcoholic or food behavior, however you want to call it. And at that point, all bets are off. I'm definitely going to do damage, and that destructive spy inside of me, he's always there. He's definitely a he. And he's not a very friendly person, that spy, that sneaky guy. And when I look at the photographs of myself as this humongous dude, I felt shame. My daughter was there with me. I looked at this photograph, and as the time has gone by, and speaking with my sponsor, I suddenly have the compassion for that guy. I can look at myself instead of feeling shame. I can feel love and I can feel that pain. I can talk to that teenager and be a parent to myself, which is one of the things that this program has really helped me with. So, control and letting go of control is central to my recovery. Having a healthy relationship with food is central to my recovery. Sharing, being of service, having a community is central. And knowing that this is not perfect, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes every day. I make mistakes. I make mistakes. And, I said earlier that I have a regret
One
about my
minute
mom.
warning.
It's not a regret. It's just I'm sad that she died. Dolly Parton said yesterday, I listened to an interview of her, she regrets nothing because every decision she made, she did in the way that she felt was right at the time. And I echo that. I think that any excuse to beat myself up is my disease at work. So I, in surrendering and in honoring my higher power and in loving myself in the dark and the light, that's about acceptance. So I hope this share hasn't been too garbled. The real message I want to say to you is that this is the most beautiful example of humanity at work, this program, the 12 steps. It is the proof that we can love each other, we can love ourselves, we can help each other. It's not about money, it's not about agenda. I don't want anything from you, any of you, apart from to be of service to you. And that purity is the proof that there is God. That purity is the proof that I have hope and that I get to live my life, experience the difficult feelings, and realize that by breathing, just by breathing, that's where God is. And by trusting and realizing that there is such a thing as life after death, there is such a thing as love. Loving oneself, even if it's painful. And if anyone is going through really, really difficult stuff they don't feel anyone can cope with, I promise you, I can cope with any of your difficulties. So I'm going to put my number in the chat. I'm available to be called. And I really look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for letting me share.